It was a development that any of us would be excited to see happen. His hobby had become something more. Anthony had worked as a draper for most of his adult life, but in the late 1630s, he hit one of those smooth patches we dream of. His business was successful, his community loved him, and the local government had even given him a fat, juicy contract. So he took on a hobby. Remember, Anthony sold cloth by day, but in his spare time, he learned to grind glass discs into viewing lenses. At first, it was a fun way for him to look at the quality of the threads in his merchandise, but hobbies rarely stay small, right? Within a few years, he was looking deeper into everyday objects than just about anyone else in the world. In 1674, he documented protozoa and bacteria. 3 years later, he had identified the spermatozoa from a variety of animals. Soon, he became the first person to ever see red blood cells. What really blew things up for him, no pun intended, I swear, was when he looked through his lens at droplets of water. There, moving around in a substance that he had assumed was transparent and empty, were living creatures. Excited, Anthony called them animalcules, tiny animals, and hired an illustrator to draw them so that others could see them as well. Today, Anthony van Leeuwenhoek is considered by many to be the father of microbiology. But at a more basic level, his hobby demonstrated a universal truth. There is so much left to explore, and if we dig deep enough, we might uncover something truly groundbreaking. And sometimes, that discovery might lead to something else. Fear. I'm Aaron Mankey, and this is Lore. The Himalayas are one of those places on the globe that people think they understand, but really don't. Ask a few people, and most of them will give you the basic answer. The Himalayas are a mountain range. But there's so much more to them than that. In fact, the Himalayas are really three mountain ranges, all running parallel to each other. The Sivalik Hills are on the southern edge, and the lower Himalayas run along the north side. And of course, right down their middle runs the biggest of them all, the Great Himalayas. And together, they mark the spot where the Indian subcontinent ends and China begins. Now, I've spent most of my life imagining the Himalayas as snow-covered wastelands. I'm guessing a lot of other people have done the same. It probably doesn't help that the name Himalaya is based on two Sanskrit words meaning snow and dwelling. But in truth, the climate there ranges from vast tracts of snow and ice to subtropical regions and even desert. And the mountains are home to an incredible variety of life. Not only are there over 50 million people living in that region, but a huge variety of plants and animals not found anywhere else in the world, from the snow leopard to the musk deer and everything in between. There's so much to see there. Which is why the mountains have drawn explorers for a very long time. One of them was a man named James Principo, born in England in 1799. Being the 10th child born to his parents, life was probably already an uphill climb. But it was a job in India that finally pulled him out of the mundane and into the extraordinary. Now, officially, he worked at the assay department at a mint in India, testing and assessing the metals used to make coins. But while he was there, far from home, James loved to explore. So that's why, in 1832, he found himself traveling in the portion of the Himalayas that cut through Nepal. In his account of that trip, he made mention of a number of amazing sights and experiences. But one stands out as more bizarre than the rest. While in the mountains, he claimed to have seen something that was both human-like and otherworldly. A few years later, another British man in Nepal, a guy named Brian Houghton Hodgson, recorded a similar experience. He claimed that one day, as he and his guides trekked through the snowy mountains, they all saw a creature in the distance that he described as a wild man. His guides, though, used other words, some of which translated as demons. It walked on two legs, he said, but was also covered in hair from head to toe. And then, a few decades later, the sightings transitioned into something better. Physical proof. Lawrence Waddell was a military surgeon who had served in the British Indian Army in the 1880s. It was a posting that took him everywhere in the region, from Tibet and China to Burma and beyond. And then in 1889, he found something amazing. He had been exploring Sikkim, a state in northeastern India that's home to a stretch of the Himalayas, including the world's third highest peak. And it was while exploring the frigid slopes high up in the mountains where Waddell and his guides encountered something unbelievable in the snow. "Some large footprints in the snow," he wrote, "led across our track and away up to the higher peaks. These were alleged to be the trail of the hairy wild men who are believed to live amongst the eternal snows. The belief in these creatures is universal amongst Tibetans." And the name for those creatures was quickly given to him. Pointing to the enormous footprints in the snow, one of his Sherpas told him what sort of monster had made them. The Yeti. Stories of large, hairy, wild men are pretty much guaranteed wherever you look. They seem to be as common as rainfall and birdsong. No matter what new land you step into, there's a good chance you can track down stories about them. Of course, most of us immediately conjure up images of the North American legends of Bigfoot or Sasquatch. It's often described as a very tall, ape-like creature that walks on two legs like a human, but is covered in hair or fur from head to foot. We've discussed some of these North American folktales here in the past, but Bigfoot might also be one of the most famous cryptids in the world, right up there with the Loch Ness Monster and the Chupacabra. And there might be a reason why. Halfway around the world in the Philippines, there are similar stories. The Amamango has a familiar description too, an ape the size of a man who walks upright and is covered in hair. The Amamango is described as violent and dangerous, and a multitude of attacks on people has been recorded over the centuries. So much so, in fact, that local authorities have warned the general public to keep an eye out for it. According to reports, the creature has been blamed for slaughtered livestock and even the disappearance of people. In Russia, there is a creature known as the Chuchuna, which is said to live way out in the Siberian wilderness. Taller than a human, covered in hair, and prone to violence. It sounds awfully familiar, doesn't it? The only difference I can see regarding this one is that it's occasionally described as having a tail. In Japan, there are stories about the Hibegan. This one is shorter than some of the others, maybe 5 feet in height, but is still said to be hairy and muscular. Oddly, this creature's hands are often described as covered in pale or white hair, unlike the rest of its body. One sighting in 1972 left people whispering about its deep, glaring eyes, although no violent attacks were reported. Another North American creature that's similar yet different to the more popular Bigfoot legend is the Nookluk from northwestern Canada. A handful of sightings in the 1960s described the creature as actually wearing clothing, although nothing more than a simple loincloth and rough boots. Although it's said to be covered in hair, witnesses have also mentioned a long beard, giving the Nookluk more of a wild man appearance than that of a wild beast. And in China, we can find folklore regarding a creature known as the Yeren. It's exactly what you might imagine, too, standing close to 10 feet tall, covered in fur, and hiding away from human civilization inside the wooded wilderness. Amazingly, stories of a creature fitting the Yeren's description date back over 2,000 years, often highlighting its odd juxtaposition of human and animal characteristics. And maybe because of their reported behavior, preying on humans, often attacking or kidnapping them, along with some of its more human-like features, a long beard and primitive weapons, it's no wonder that some historians have theorized that the stories are twisted versions of early encounters with Iron Age Europeans. But few regions have begged for answers like the Himalayan mountains. Maybe it's the thrill of reaching places few have gone before, or perhaps it's the attraction some feel to new areas of exploration and discovery. Whatever the reason, many of those who have ventured up those cold, snow-covered rocks have brushed up against physical evidence of the legendary Yeti. And what they found is terrifying. We've all heard of Beatlemania, right? That moment in the 1960s when it seemed like every living person on Earth was under the spell of those four young musicians from England. Well, a decade earlier, it was Yeti mania. All those earlier reports of explorers who had wandered up into the thin air of the Himalayas and encountered evidence of a mysterious creature had left the general public wanting more. And for that, someone had to be brave enough to go get it. In 1942, for example, two hikers in the mountains spotted movement in the distance. Now, remember, up in the snow and pale blue sky, there's a lot of contrast, so it's easy to spot dark objects from a distance. It's mostly bits of stone peeking out from gaps in the snow, but every now and then, the objects move. Well, these two hikers spotted what they claimed was a human-like creature, walking away from them, about a quarter of a mile down mountain from where they stood. They somehow were able to ballpark the creature's height at about 8 feet tall, and could even make out physical details like its dark, hairy body and powerful build. Others who ventured into the mountains sometimes returned with things they claimed were physical evidence of the creature's existence. Even Hollywood superstar Jimmy Stewart got in on the Yeti mania. How so? Well, it seems that he purchased a finger that someone claimed had come from one of the creatures. And if the legend is true, he smuggled it out of Nepal by hiding it in his wife's luggage. It's a legend about a legend, of course, so take it all with a grain of salt. But the story of the finger, if you'll pardon the pun, certainly makes a point. People had become obsessed with the Yeti. But the most fascinating story of exploration and the Yeti, hands down, took place in 1951. It centers on a mountaineer named Eric Shipton, who was an Englishman born in Sri Lanka back in 1907. His father passed away when Eric was a young boy, and he was sent back to London to finish his education, and eventually discovered a love for the mountains on a family vacation to the Pyrenees, between Spain and France. And that was a passion he quickly leaned into. In 1929, at the age of just 22, he climbed to the top of Nelion, one of the peaks of Mount Kenya. 2 years later, he scaled Kamet, the second tallest mountain in India. And then he set his sights on Everest. Clearly, Eric Shipton was passionate about mountain climbing, and he was good at it. For the next 20 years or so, he dominated Everest, participating in most of the expeditions there. In 1951, though, he was joined by Edmund Hillary, a man who would return 2 years later with his partner and Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, who would be the first people to ever reach the summit of Everest. And Eric and Edmund witnessed something incredible on that 1951 climb. According to Edmund, who wrote about the experience later, the pair had encountered a series of footprints that caught their attention, partly because it meant that there had been someone else in their vicinity fairly recently, but mostly because of their size, because these tracks were huge. After following the trail for a way down the glacier, they started to notice other unusual clues. There were a handful of large claw marks on the edge of the ice at the mouth of a crevasse. It was the sort of gap in the glacier that would require rope and climbing gear to get across, and yet matching claw marks could be seen on the other side, as if whatever had made them had simply jumped across. To document their find, one of them laid their ice axe down beside a footprint to give it a sense of scale, and then Eric took a series of photographs. Today, if you poke around on the internet looking for stories of the Yeti, that photo is one of the most common that you'll see. A legendary clue in a centuries-long journey to uncover the truth at the center of the stories. Edmund Hillary wrote about the size of the footprint in relation to his own large feet, and made sure to point out the toe marks in the snow, as if whoever or whatever left the tracks had been walking through the snow barefoot. And of course, coming from two well-respected explorers like Shipton and Hillary, the photos and story were gobbled up by an eager public. Yeti mania continued for many years after that, all fueled by the hint of answers just out of reach. Sightings became so frequent that the United States government got involved, issuing a Foreign Service dispatch through the State Department that instructed Americans how to behave and respond should they ever encounter a Yeti. And of course, Edmund Hillary would return to the mountains there. In fact, just a year later, in 1952, he found more evidence to back up the legends. While climbing across a series of glaciers, one of the guides who was with him pointed toward a dark object on the surface of the snow before picking it up. Curious, Hillary held out his hand to take a look at it, and the Sherpa passed it over. It was hair, a large clump of dark, long, bristle-like hair, the sort you might expect to pull off an animal. or if you're inclined to believe the stories, off a yet-to-be-documented monster. Some legends have a way of acting like appetizers. They offer just enough to make your mouth water, but lack the substance to replace a full meal. They tease us into expecting more, but leave us waiting and hoping. Today, in the early 21st century, stories of the Yeti seem to be everywhere. It's a character that has appeared in various pop culture moments, from Monsters, Inc. and Scooby-Doo, to the classic 1964 Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer TV special, where it wasn't really mean and dangerous, it just needed a tooth pulled. It might even be fun to know that the very first few episodes of this podcast, back in 2015, were recorded on a microphone called, you guessed it, a Yeti. But while the legend has grown, many of the pieces of evidence that people have collected have lost their power. Jimmy Stewart's Yeti finger was tested in 2011 and determined to be human, not a monster. And many of the hair samples found have been narrowed down to a rare but known to science species of bear. It seems that if the goal is to find definitive proof, we're going to have to keep searching and hoping. One last story you might find interesting. Back in 1921, an early explorer named Charles Howard Bury led an expedition up the slopes of Mount Everest. They wouldn't reach the summit, of course, but it was one of the early attempts at the north face of the mountain. And during the climb, Bury and his companions came across some enormous footprints in the snow. When they spotted them, one of Bury's guides pointed to the tracks and told him that they belonged to a creature called the Meto Kengmi, a name that translated into English as the Man-Bear Snowman. Bury saw other clues on that climb as well, including what he claimed to be the creature itself moving quickly through the snow high above them, in the region above the 17,000-foot elevation. So, naturally, when he descended the mountain, he was eager to talk about his experience. And one man who wanted to hear about it was a journalist named Henry Newman. But this Newman, it turns out, was pretty bad at translating things, and his pass at the creature's name, the Meto Kengmi, gave him a weird English term, the filthy snowman, which didn't seem to roll off the tongue. And as a journalist, Newman was interested in giving his readers something more substantial to sink their teeth into. So he swapped out filthy for another word, and in doing so, gave pop culture exactly what they needed. The word, abominable. The Yeti represents a holy grail for many lovers of monsters, mysteries, and putting the historical pieces together to find a bigger truth. And as people have shown over the years, that tension between doubting the stories and believing them to be true has proven very attractive for people looking for evidence. And what would they do with that proof? Well, they would put it on display, of course, because as humans, we love to put the unusual and fascinating on display. In fact, that's the entire impulse behind one of America's most intriguing cultural relics, the American Sideshow. And that's why the Grim and Mild team and I have built an entire show around the concept. Starting Friday, January 7th, you can subscribe and listen to a brand new series we call Grim and Mild Presents. And for our inaugural season, we'll dive deep into what the Sideshow was all about. And if you stick around through this brief sponsor break, I'll give you an early preview. Step right up, folks. The Sideshow is about to begin. This episode of Lore was made possible by Squarespace. Are you ready to start something new? Maybe you dreamt up an idea over the holiday break, or you're in the final stages of launching something new. I know exactly what you're feeling because this podcast started out as a new idea almost 7 years ago. And the thing that helped it feel more real than many other tools? The website. Because the moment I saw the Lore website up and running, everything felt possible. And I couldn't have done it without Squarespace. Squarespace allows you to build your ideal website with drag-and-drop editing controls with a ton of amazing features. Check out the Lore website for a demonstration of just how great your website can be. It was so easy to build. Plus, Squarespace has a huge library of beautifully designed templates to help get you started, powerful e-commerce features, free hosting, and award-winning 24/7 customer support. Squarespace has everything you need to give your new project a clean professional face. Get started today for free. Just visit squarespace.com/lore to start your free trial website. And when you're ready to launch, be sure to use the offer code LORE at checkout to save 10%. Squarespace. Build something beautiful. This episode was also made possible by SimpliSafe. If you've ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there is no better time than now. Right now, our friends at SimpliSafe are giving Lore listeners access to all their New Year's holiday deals, 20% off their award-winning home security, and your first month for free when you sign up for the interactive monitoring service. I use SimpliSafe at the office, and I couldn't get over how easy it was to set up or how simple it is to use on a regular basis. Between the high-quality hardware and their helpful app on my phone, I never worry. SimpliSafe has everything you need to make your home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, and all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant you need it. You can easily customize a system for your home online in minutes and even get free custom recommendations from SimpliSafe. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to start feeling a bit more peace of mind. Hurry! Take 20% off your SimpliSafe system and get your first month for free when you sign up for the interactive monitoring system. Visit simplisafe.com/lore. Again, that's simplisafe.com/lore for 20% off your entire system. And finally, this episode was sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We talk about BetterHelp a lot on this show, and this month we're discussing some of the stigmas around mental health. For example, some people think that you should wait until things are unbearable to go to therapy, but that isn't true. Therapy is a tool to utilize before things get worse, and it can help you avoid those lows. And we've been taught that mental health shouldn't be a part of normal life, but that's wrong too. We take care of our bodies with the gym, the doctor, and nutrition. We should be focusing on our minds just as much. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp Online Therapy. And Lore listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/lore. That's betterhelp.com/lore. Taylor had always believed that he was destined for greatness. As a young boy in the tiny village of Bethel, Connecticut, he felt like a king. A shrewd, pint-sized sales clerk at his father's general store, he drove a mean bargain with a mix of Yankee wit and thrift. He had big shoes to fill, after all. He was named after his grandfather, Phineas Taylor, who was an old sage and loved by all. Phineas, so pleased to have a small protege of his own, purchased Taylor, and I quote, "the greatest farmland in all of Connecticut," which made him the richest kid in town. And everyone else knew it. Not a week went by without Uncle Finn waxing poetic to Taylor of this grand inheritance, a place by the name of Ivy Island. In Taylor's mind, it must have looked something like El Dorado, mines of gold, outcroppings of emerald, diamonds all aglow. A place where you could pluck rubies from trees and silver from streams. His autobiography talks about visions of milk and honey, and on a practical level, we can think this picture included some cows and chickens, being New England in 1822, after all. So when the time came to finally visit the land, his land, Taylor was ready. He was 12 and all grown up. He left town early that morning with a family friend. They trekked for hours, and we're not talking about rolling hills of grassland. No, they mucked through swamp. This couldn't be right, though. We can imagine Taylor, like any other kid, asking, "Are we there yet?" But then they stopped. And where they stopped didn't turn out to be the island of his wildest dreams. Not at all. In front of him was a slice of squishy, boggy ground. It was muddy, ugly, dotted with scraggly trees and mosquitoes, and filled with stink and snakes. And then it hit him. This was one of his grandfather's infamous practical jokes. And worse, the whole town had been in on it. For years. Taylor had left his home that morning ready for retirement and returned a laughing stock. We can imagine that he went back to his job at the register feeling a bit miffed and also scheming, because Taylor never forgot that lesson. The years went on, He worked hard and loved the barter and banter of country life. He was a quick talker, jovial, a teller of tall tales, a charmer. He traded in commodities and gossip, but he eventually took a job in Brooklyn and developed a taste for the spectacle of city life. Still, home had a hold on him. His granddad implored him to come back, so he did. It was back in Connecticut that he met Charity Hallett. Soon the two were married, and then Taylor set up a new shop with a co-conspirator, or at least company along for the ride. It was here that he kept dreaming of riches and how to get them. Taylor's magic was people. His emotional radar was finely tuned to the desires, wants, and secrets of his customers, catering to their whims and imaginations. At his newly minted store, he sold everything from Bibles to brandy to lottery tickets. A little something for everyone. He had a natural sense for psychology, and he was going to capitalize on it. America in the mid-1800s, you see, was quickly changing. Religious revivals were in full swing. The nation was quickly industrializing. Immigration was on the rise, and the young country was beginning to look west to far-flung places. The word scientist entered the vocabulary for the first time, and a war that would fracture the country loomed ahead. And Taylor wanted to ride these new waves, so he bought a printing press. He believed that words had power, and that they would take him further than his horse could run. He wanted to reach people in the world beyond Bethel. On October 19th of 1831, he began printing his weekly Herald of Freedom. It fit right in with the trend of independent newspapers being sold on street corners in major cities across the nation. And Taylor wanted a slice of that pie. He wanted the freedom to share his ideas, to advertise, to call people to action. He saw an opportunity to wrestle control of the narrative, to spin yarns in his own fashion, much like his grandfather Phineas had done all those years before. It was his turn to become a bona fide, widely respected storyteller. Well, most of the time. You see, Taylor did like to get mouths wagging. He loved to stir up controversy with his paper, and it wasn't long before his affinity landed him in a Connecticut jail for libel. While in this jail cell, one he decorated with carpets and other cozy furnishings from home, he had an idea. He gathered his friends and created what he called the Committee of Arrangements. They spread the word of his imprisonment and impending release far and wide, both through word of mouth and through his printing press. We can imagine that on the day of his release, he put on his best suit, threw his shoulders back, and marched out of his cell and into a throng of thousands, his audience, and their applause. Picture this, will you? Horse-drawn carriages astride dusty town roads, a marching band blaring brass, cannon fire on the green, sticky champagne toasts, and revelry carrying on deep into the night. All for him. At 22 and back in the world, he had made a statement. The show business career of Phineas Taylor Barnum had arrived. This episode of Lore was written and produced by me, Aaron Mankey, with research by Ali Steed and music by Chad Lawson. Lore is much more than just a podcast. There's a book series available in bookstores and online, and two seasons of the television show on Amazon Prime Video. Check them both out if you want more lore in your life. I also make and executive produce a whole bunch of other podcasts, all of which I think you'd enjoy. My production company, Grim and Mild, specializes in shows that sit at the intersection of the dark and the historical. You can learn more about all of those shows and everything else going on over in one central place, grimandmild.com. And you can also follow this show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for Lore Podcast, all one word, and then click that follow button. And when you do, say hi. I like it when people say hi. And as always, thanks for listening.